Welcome to episode 125 of the Omni Gamers Club podcast, the podcast for games on all platforms, including Spot the Difference. I am Daniel Winter.
And this is Mark Yuasa. Hello, Daniel. How are you doing?
Good. I'm coming in fresh from 3 days of ProtoCon, so you'll have to excuse a little bit of exhaustion today. Quite overstimulated, especially having... I basically took my six-year-old kid there today as well, so... was wrangling her, but had a lot of fun. I'll be talking a little bit more about that later. But we've also got 3 courses of games to discuss. So how are you doing, Mark?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty well. I had a much quieter weekend than you, so I'm eager to hear how the ProtoCon event went. But I have some material for our appetizer, which is kind of like news and what's happening. Of course, we have a main topic that we'll bring each, which is a deeper dive. And then we'll be doing our dessert, which is kind of off-topic topic, to wrap it up. So, yeah, I'm happy to dive in if you are.
Yeah, I mean, may as well tangent straight into the ProtoCon talk. I mean, I'd hoped to meet you there and compare some thoughts. As you learned, obviously, the event was sold out, which is good news to have, obviously. I helped out a little bit with the organization of this, but not in any elaborate way. But I was... cautiously worried about how much interest there is for a playtesting convention on the playtesting side. Obviously, lots of designers always looking for playtesters. It's a struggle to get people together to focus in just on that. It's hard to convince your friends or strangers to play a prototype game. But, you know, we had about 50 designers and 300 people total. So lots of games going around, and most of the tables were packed all weekend. So that was great to see that there is interest in playtesting as a sort of as its own thing, not just, you know, playing games, but playtesting them, developing them, being involved in that process. I think, is that something you've done much in the past, Mark?
Yeah, I have done events for playtesting on a much smaller scale. I haven't attended a dedicated playtesting event, a larger event like this, but I've attended smaller individual game jams or kind of like weekly kind of game designers meetups. Even at those, I was surprised. Let's just say you had 50 designers, like there might be like 5 designers at a weekly event. And I was still surprised at how willing there were people were to devote their time to help play test games. I mean, like, they don't conceivably get anything out of it. Maybe they're aspiring game designers who just want to receive some inspiration. You know, that was certainly the case with me when I attended a lot of these events. But a lot of people are just willing to devote their time, give up their time, or maybe they want to be part of the process. You know, like a lot of the times designers will give out thanks to the playtesters in rules manuals if the games ever end up being published. And it's a generally really positive environment here in Vancouver. That's where I've done most of my playtesting. And yeah, it's really cool to hear that it was such a great turnout.
Yeah, I mean, obviously at some of these smaller events, a lot of it is reciprocal. It's like, if you have a game that you want playtested, well, you playtest everyone else's first, and then you sort of share it around. And I mean, there's something special too about designers playtesting each other's games and that they know how to give good feedback. And that was something I was mindful of this weekend, is like, how do I give constructive feedback that's helping the game be what the designer wants it to be, not necessarily a game that I would prefer. Like, I don't want it. No, every game has to be for me in that sense. So that's something I'd like to work on. And I think I'd suggested potentially doing an event next year for like lessons in how to be a good playtester, how to be a better playtester. I don't think I necessarily talk much about the specific games that I saw there, just because I think there's more hesitation in the board game community to sort of make public games that are still in development, more so than in video games, at least, where there's a big sort of early access sort of culture. But I mean, this is very much almost like the alpha level games that are not in a state necessarily to be, you know, marketed around just yet. So, I mean, the games that I saw were in a wide range of states, from, you know, I made this up last week and it's my first playtest, to this basically looks like it's ready to hit publish, right? It's pretty elaborate. productions. It's great to see people. I mean, some of these games people have been working on for years, like 5-6 years. There really are labors of love. And some of these people like never have any intentions of them being retail products, which I think is something beautiful about events like this. Is like we talked a little bit about indie markets last week. Oh, Ted's back. I want to double back on the indie markets at some point in a future episode, but I think something they just have in common is that games that don't fit into this traditional publishing niche still can have a chance to shine and be special and exist and have an audience. And they're still labors of love, and they still have something interesting to say. And yeah, I think it's great to see the diversity of what the board game community can come up with.
Right. It's a very different distinction between tabletop and video games. Usually a lot of games that are video game form kind of have a niche or a marketing angle or maybe a license that's a tie-in that is already known from the outset, whereas a lot of the games start as just a game mechanism or like a rough concept. And then even if the game is fortunate enough to be picked up by a publisher, then quite often that publisher will decide to apply a brand new theme or an overlay or provide their own design feedback in terms of the gameplay mechanisms or offer more detailed kind of what they call development on top of it, which is like refinement overall. So I think a tabletop game can very drastically change from the conceptual phase, the development, the primary game design phase to, you know, pre-production. It can become an entirely different creature. And maybe that's why you don't hear a lot in advance about games other than, you know, hey, there's this media property has received a board game tie-in or something to that effect.
There's this real hesitation in some corners of board gaming to like relinquish your ideas as if everything is in the idea. I think there's this overemphasis on ideas being the most important part of it. I mean, obviously, you see all these people invested in generative AI who think, you know, ideas are all it takes to have something unique, right? And that I think which detracts from the execution that goes into making these games work and iterating on them, you know, dozens of times. That's what these playtests are for. Really fascinating to see that. I'm looking forward to this being the first of many such events. It did inspire me to dust off one of my old designs that I hadn't touched in several years and get a few new ideas for that. I've got a bit of a goal now that maybe I can try showing that off. We're getting into a state where I can basically show it off next ProtoCon, potentially.
It's great to have a deadline, absolutely. Some of my most productive work was when I was participating in the Buttonshy Games kind of game of the month. Like there was basically like a theme for a month. And obviously, if you have to comply to some sort of design constraint, you have to throw out a lot of the hemming and hawing and just get down to business, get down to brass tacks and work within those constraints. And I found that very, very fruitful. And I feel like if there's anyone out there in our audience who's, interested, maybe has been sitting on an idea for years or has been working on an idea for years, I highly recommend that they do get their games out in front of people to play test, because quite often, maybe sometimes sad to hear, those labors of love that you've been working on in your garage for 10 years, that might never become a product, right? Even if your heart, it's your greatest desire that your magnum opus is going to get out there and revolutionize the tabletop world, it's highly likely that it's not going to do that. And also a lot of ideas are just is not feasible or could be radically improved just by getting in front of people and getting their perspective, seeing how they respond to it. I heard a good piece of advice that any recommendations that playtesters give you, you can feel free to ignore, but any feelings that they have to convey to you about their experiences in playing your game is the important thing, right? Because you can't feelings are real, right? Those are objectively important things that those players have to share with you. Their improvements, they're probably not designers that are giving you that feedback anyways. And even if they are, they're probably trying to turn your idea into something, their own game, which is not fruitful either. Yeah, get that idea out there and build upon it and make it something real. That's the real test.
Yeah, it's never going to be perfect just sitting in your basement thinking through ideas to yourself. Like, these games are only ever going to become their final form by, you know, filtering them through other people. Like it or not, games require other people. Although I did see at least one solo game being playtested this weekend, which was great to see. And then one of the other highlights was there was an 11-year-old girl was playtesting her game there with her dad. That was really gratifying to see a new generation starting out early. I took my kid in today and we tried that game and showed her around a few others. But talking about the button shy restrictions, tangents into one of the other highlights was a game jam, basically. I've participated in one of these a few years ago during the pandemic, basically. It was a digital one, but this is my first one in several years. I mean, the game jam, basically, you're given a box of components and some form of restriction or prompt, and then you have to come up with a game. And as we've discussed previously, like, that limitation breeds innovation, right? It can really focus the mind in a particular direction and create ideas that you wouldn't have thought of yourself otherwise, basically. So that was a lot of fun. I basically let my daughter just like guide the design in her own, wherever her imagination took her, basically, with like this box of components, rather than like forcing all these restrictions that she wouldn't really understand anyway. But we came up with something pretty fun there. She won like a runner-up prize, so she was pretty stoked about that. Has her own fail faster playtesting journal now, so I'll have to try and encourage her to iterate and playtest that and see if we can polish something off. So yeah, that was a fun experience, and glad to see her getting a little more engaged and enjoying the process of creating as well.
That's great to hear. Yeah, like I said, I'd previously done game jams in the past in a smaller context, primarily the ones that were run by my former podcast partner, Mark Ellis.
Well, he was running today's.
Very good. He's an old hand at this. So he is a member, helps run Vancouver Playtest Group. And he's run a number of these over the years. And just like you said, you get like a few components, you get some inspiration kits, you get some constraints. And most important, you have a time limit. And most people hear time limit and they say, oh my goodness, I can't deal with time limits. But the opposite is maybe even more dangerous, is an unlimited amount of time. Because if you have an unlimited amount of time, it's never going to get done. Because you don't have a constraint. And probably professional designers that have to produce games on a regular basis will tell you that a game is never done. It's only due. Deadlines are real. They're real motivators.
Well, it's worth noting this was also a team-based game jam. I mean, most of the teams were like three or four people. I took my daughter and let her just do her own thing. So she wasn't sort of distracting other people from their ideas. But like, if you don't feel like you have the chops to be, you know, a game designer, I'd still encourage you to like go and join one of these team-based game jams without the pressure of coming up with all the ideas yourself, and just, you know, collaborate and come up with something unique. And it's a good chance to practice some of those skills and you know, train those muscles and just try something a little different on the other side of the aisle.
Right. Game jams are ultimately, whether they're for physical games or video games, for instance, are about getting out of your comfort zone. And if you throw together some people, especially people that don't know each other, you learn about each other and you get to test your skills, maybe find some skills that you didn't know that you had.
And you don't need actual, you know, computer skills like if you're doing a video game jam.
Yeah, it's true. I remember doing a 48-hour game jam where we produced a very small video game, and it took a lot of time, sweat, and tears, and not a lot of sleep. so, yeah, time constraints are a very valuable motivator for sure.
Excellent. One final note I forgot to mention was that I also saw two TTRPGs being playtested at Protocon, which I imagine, like, I spoke to both designers briefly. I imagine that's a whole different set of skills in terms of how you go about, you know, playtesting one of those, a lot more iteration. And I mean, it's a lot of GM work, basically, and that's already a lot of work to start with, essentially. So yeah, fascinating to see that side of things in the TTRPGs, which is even less of a less spoken about, I think.
Yeah, I think it is very active in a smaller smaller platforms, I suppose you could say. There's a lot of talk on Reddit and Itch and places like that. But yeah, they have some really clever game jam ideas, like one-page RPGs.
Mm.
You know, one-page RPGs aren't new to everyone. They've been around for years, maybe decades, you could say. But, you know, single-page games like Lasers and Feelings, which I've mentioned in a previous episode, can do a real lot with a limited amount of space. And I think they even have things like 12-word RPGs or things like that. So, yeah, RPGs definitely do need playtesting. I think we had our guest on, I forget who it was, for one of our recent episodes saying that, you know, I don't really play TTRPGs because there's I can't deal with no rules. It's like, TTRPGs have rules. It's just more of a question of how do you interpret them. That's the real crux. But yeah, definitely TTRPGs need their playtesting as well. And I haven't had the opportunity to try it myself, but actually maybe that's not true. Maybe I did try it once with a one-page RPG I did with my kids in the past. That was pretty fun.
Interesting. Actually, you know, another quick tangent is that I met a few people there who were involved in another convention last weekend that was specifically TTRPGs for kids. My kid wasn't quite old enough to attend that yet, but I'm looking forward to trying that in the future. I got a couple of ideas, the things to try here with in the meantime.
Oh, nice. Maybe I should hire you and your kid to help me playtest my one-page RPG, since you're not going to be as familiar with the subject material as my kids were. We'll see if it works equally well with yours. Very cool. Any more interesting things from Protocon?
Go ahead. What's your appetizer for this week?
Cool. Yeah, my news is not so fresh as this, and it's out there in the world, not so local, but I'm going to sandwich one bad news story and then one good story. Okay, so we unfortunately have seen a lot of layoffs this year, not just in the video game industry, but in other industries as well. A lot of the global changes happening right now in politics. But this one is not out of North America, which we've seen the bulk of layoffs happening recently. This one is happening in out of a Japanese company, Square Enix. But employees in the US and UK offices are also being affected. Basically, this is an effort, a broader effort to consolidate its publishing organization and focus its development work in Japan, they say. So basically, employees over 100 are being let go. We don't know the precise amounts because the numbers weren't available at the time of the news printing, but employees are being dismissed in their UK and US offices. And in the very same press release, they announced that they expect to reduce their QA or quality assurance staff by as much as 70% in consideration, in planning to use AI to serve the same purpose. So we don't even have human beings ensuring the quality of our software products anymore. Oh, we can just let faulty software do that for us. So that's a very unfortunate turn of events, I think. There's a reason why good quality assurance is so important, is because real, capable, really smart human engineers handle a lot of that. I know that myself because I work in software development. So I think it's a bad move. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, as we were just talking about playtesting, it does take a real skill to be able to, you know, do QA on games in a constructive way. It just seems so rich for these companies to want to give this all to AI, where it seems like they don't even want people playing the games anymore. They want games made by AI, being played by AI, it seems. It's just all part of this sort of speculation investment bubble. They don't actually care about a game being made. They just want a product and numbers going up, essentially, it seems, when publishers get to this size. It's not hard to imagine why they're divesting themselves from the uncertainty of the US market. I can certainly feel for them a little bit there, but like at the end of the day, it's all about number go up for them, obviously.
Yeah, it's true. It's, you know, I maybe naively thought that a lot of Japanese companies, especially ones with kind of like more longer histories, like Nintendo and Square Enix, would be a little bit more insulated from some of the fast-moving market-based planning that often seems to affect US and European publishers, publisher developers. But Square Enix has not been immune to some really potentially dubious business decisions of late. You know, you can even take it all the way back to the decision to produce that CG animated movie like 20 years ago or something like that. That was a big investment that didn't work out really well. They made some really questionable choices recently, like making the second Final Fantasy remaster only available on the PlayStation 5. I think more recently it's come out on PC, but limiting it to one platform obviously reduces the number of copies you can sell, and that particular entry has underperformed sales-wise. And like for the same reasons, Final Fantasy 16 has also underperformed for many reasons. So now they're looking towards things like NFTs and AI to recoup some of their money. I don't know. It just seems like bad, good money after bad to me.
Yeah, I mean, obviously they're getting desperate. Like, they've made bad bets, and now they're trying to follow, you know, the safe bet. But it's just this whole AI, you know, it just seems like desperation, in which the only way out of this is to make sure that it's a good investment by doubling down on it further. It's a bit of a sunk cost fallacy, I think.
Yeah, I mean, maybe AI can produce like 50 different colors of hats for DLC to sell, but you still need human beings to create those games and create interesting characters, stories, and art. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. I think it's an unfortunate move from a publisher that I've generally tried to support over the years. Maybe not so much in the future.
Yeah, definitely hard. Like, as we've discussed before, when companies get to this size, it's pretty hard to keep them accountable in any meaningful way.
All right, so one positive piece of news. So from another one Japanese company to another, it's over to the Sony side. So I've said for a while now that I've been interested in dipping back into the Sony ecosystem because I haven't really utilized their platforms very much for a while now, since I've been mostly Xbox focused for the last probably decade or so. But I've been a Sony fan in the past. Love my PSP, love my PS Vita, which I'm really, really sad that my Vita's battery seems to have finally gone kaput after all these years. And it's really sad because that system is a powerhouse, especially with modern modding capabilities. And that screen is just insane on the first edition. So I think I'm going to have to do a little bit of tinkering and rejuvenate, maybe plug in a new battery for that one. But anyways, that aside, one positive news out of Sony is that they're kind of like odd duck portable platform, the PlayStation Portal, which hasn't sold big numbers, despite the fact that its small subset of fans really, really love this device, has had a major feature improvement. So before this improvement, this device was basically a second screen accessory just for the PlayStation 5. So it cannot natively play games on its own. You cannot install games on this platform. It's basically a screen with the same capabilities of the, I think they're called, what are they called, DualSense, the new remotes for the PS5 controller. It has the same HD rumble, same capabilities as that baked in, attached to an 8-inch, not OLED, but LCD screen. And it was expressly developed to stream games from PS5. So if your living room was taken up by your kids watching a movie or something like that, you could play your, whatever, Final Fantasy 16.
It's like the Wii U all over again.
Yeah, for sure. And because a lot of people kind of just didn't know what this is, like, is this a standalone thing? It's not a standalone thing. You need to have a PS5 anyways. A PS5 is a pretty expensive device on its own, let alone the controllers, which cost, you know, $80 US, $100 Canadian. It's not a cheap ecosystem to buy into, and then this would just be another expense on top of that. But just recently they announced that you now have the capability to play PS5 games on the PlayStation Portal without a PS5. So this works in two ways. Unlike other ways that you could, for instance, like stream Xbox games from an Xbox onto your phone, you would have to have your local Xbox on and running in your house somewhere. And that's previously how the PlayStation Portal works. Now, with this update, your PlayStation 5 doesn't have to be on. Or it could be on, and another person could be playing it on it on their account. Now, you can stream certain PlayStation 5 games, of which hundreds are supported, from their cloud server, their cloud gaming ecosystem. And that includes all the PlayStation 5 supported games on PlayStation Plus as well. Now, you only have the capability to stream games on the PlayStation Portal if you subscribe to the PlayStation Plus Premium subscription, which is their highest tier. But still, that is at, I think it's at about $20 Canadian per month, which is still, what, two-thirds the price of the highest Xbox Game Pass program. So I think if you look at it that way, it's really powerful. It's kind of like what GeForce Now allows you to do, which is having a powerful cloud gaming platform, except GeForce Now doesn't give you a gaming library. PlayStation Plus does. So part of me is kind of really tempted to pick up a PlayStation Portal, even though I don't have a PlayStation 5. Because with PS Plus Premium, I could play on my PlayStation Portal, and that's a lot of peace. But it would be a less expensive way to get into the PlayStation gaming ecosystem for this generation.
I've definitely been interested more in the PlayStation ecosystem, having dropped Xbox now. There's a few exclusives I've been wanting to double back on, like Astrobot. It was the whole Astro series, essentially. But I heard some discussion about this on Remap, and I didn't have time to look into. Like, I still don't know what the size of the portal is, how much it costs. It still seems like, at this point, still a fairly big investment to, you know, buy the device, subscribe to, you know, PlayStation Plus, and still not own anything, really?
It is true. It's not, there's no doubt about that. But compare it to the price of the PlayStation 5 itself, it's a considerable difference. For instance, the PS Portal has been out for a while now. It's been out for over a year, I think. And you can get it brand new at $269 Canadian.
It's a little bad.
Not very bad. The 30th edition, 30th anniversary PlayStation edition is still available for $299. You can get an open box of this for $210, $215 Canadian, which is in Switch Lite territory, adjacent pricing. So that's really inexpensive hardware compared to your $700-$800 PlayStation 5, depending on which model you get. And like I said, PlayStation Premium is still two-thirds the cost of the highest Game Pass, Xbox Game Pass price. Plus, you get a bunch of other advantages as well. Like, I could play certain PlayStation Plus games on my PS4, which I do have, which does work. And you gain access to some of Sony's movie library as well. So there are some advantages. There's the Ubisoft Classic library as well. So for the right individual, it could be a really good price point, I think.
It's not a lot for something that is just a streaming machine with not really much processing power in itself. What I'd be more interested in is basically, I think, what was used to be called like the PlayStation TV or something, basically an Apple TV box. It's a box that you can plug into your TV and stream to your TV screen rather than a handheld. I'd be more interested in that, to be honest.
I have a PS Vita TV sitting over there. In fact, I could be using that to be playing some of my Vita games, but not having that crisp OLED screen is a real downer. And playing 720p on your
scaling
4K
up
TV
to the giant TVs,
is not exact. It's kind of a bummer. Like, let's face it, that bubble UI of the old Vita is not the best UI around there in the world. Anyways, these are all very niche products for niche audiences. But for myself, I'm kind of attracted to this concept. I'm really considering jumping on board the bandwagon.
Yeah, I'm definitely look into that more, maybe. Think about that Christmas shopping list, perhaps.
I'll let you know how it goes, depending on what happens.
Excellent. Well, that's a long appetizer. I think we should jump to our main course.
Let's do it. All right. Did you want to start us off?
Sure. Why not? I mean, mine will be relatively short. I am a little mindful that we haven't discussed many tabletop games in the main lately. That's been tricky just in terms of getting people together. I have been playing some board games with my kid and one of my friends. A lot of two-player games, and it's hard to give a game it's you know, really get into the weeds and test it thoroughly, in a sense that I don't want to like give an overall review here. So maybe I should bring some of those back to like the appetizer and just give some more impressions there when try and get some slow news weeks in the next little bit. And hopefully,
you and I have been playing some tabletop RPGs of late, which we are going to cover, but we're going to try and. Trying to basically nail down some guests and get some more experiences under our belt. So we will be talking about those experiences.
Yeah, we're just synchronizing up. Yeah. So in the meantime, I'm still wrapping up my Halloween spooky closet with one final game that I played on Halloween Eve was The Cabin Factory. So this was developed by International Cat Studios, published by Future Friends Games, released on 13th of December 2024, but came to Switch in October this year, which is where I played it. So in case that wasn't clear, this is a video game. I feel like we haven't been clarifying that as much as we possibly should. But so this is part of a relatively new genre. I don't know if there's a name for it, but like it's sort of escape games or exit games. I don't know if you've played any of these, Mark. Exit 8, I think, is a sort of the quintessential title in that sort of subgenre.
Yeah, Exit 8 was definitely its own thing. It's basically a very small Japanese indie game, which is themed around Japanese subway stations, essentially, and sort of their, what's the term? They're like kind of...
Liminal spaces?
Kind of ease of getting lost and the unease of these kind of very sterile surroundings. So I guess that was the inspiration for Exit 8 anyway.
Yeah, it definitely plays with a lot of horror themes, especially like there's this whole, what do they call it, creepypasta sort of lore on the internet about the back rooms, which is a whole, you know, subgenre of its own, and liminal spaces. Definitely playing in that. It's more like unsettling than scary, is my understanding. Whereas Cabin Factory is bringing that forward to a much more explicit sense of horror. So, I mean, the grand concept here is that you're working in a factory that produces, you know, cabins for Halloween showcases, basically. And you're in quality assurance, there's that term again, basically going in and checking, is this cabin haunted or not? Like, is it like they're all supposed to be scary, but is this one normal scary or spicy scary, basically? And so you have to go in and see if anything looks out of place. And then you go out again and hit the switch to whether it's safe or it's haunted. And so basically all of these cabins are the same. It's the same template every time with generally small differences. And you've got to go in and play spot the difference, essentially. Is anything out of place? So some of those are going to be fairly innocuous. Oh, there's these mannequins scattered around. They're always in slightly different positions. But as long as they don't move, then everything is fine. Like the core rule here is if anything moves, then it's haunted. Which is strange because like animatronics are like, you know, 101 of haunted houses, I guess. But in this case, nothing should be moving. They do play with that in some weird ways, like whether you see something move or if it like moved when you left the room, does that count? There's definitely some cases where like I hear some creepy noises and things are happening. The vibes are definitely off. I don't see anything move, but like I'd still hit haunted and it would be correct. So there's some ambiguity about what the rules here are. And I mean, that's part of the weird, absurd part of this is like when you hit safe or haunted, the game knows if you're correct or not. So it's not like you're really doing quality assurance. They know there is a final correct answer. It feels like more like you're doing a like an entrance exam to join the, what was the government agency in control or something like that.
The oldest house. FCB, what is that called? The
Federal Bureau of Control, that would be it, yeah.
Federal Bureau of Control. Like, there's that new game, FCB Firebreak. That's
right, yes, yeah. FCC. So it has some similar vibes, like it's all in this very stark white warehouse with these, you know, very spooky wooden cabins that feels... It's that dichotomy that you expect to see in something like Control, basically.
Yeah, I guess you pointed out, like, one of the key elements of Exit 8, this like liminal subgenre, is the kind of the spot the differences factor of it. Like this was, if I think back to it, it might not be the first originator of the genre, the subgenre, but PT had a degree of that. Infamous, I think it was Hideo Kojima demo that was never actually produced into a full-on game. The premise of it was that you were basically exploring this layout of the same house over and over and over again, but every time you kind of retread upon ground, some subtle differences might come up, which adds to the tension.
It's definitely a novel idea for horror that isn't just about, you know, shooting zombies or running away from zombies in various forms. Like, that observation, like, paying close attention to things does really prime you for a specific type of horror, though, that being jump scares. Probably my least favorite form of horror. I did find myself getting very skittish and, like, not wanting to look at things too closely. And it's just sort of, you know, psyching myself out a little bit, I think. So, it's not necessarily my sort of game. It is a very short game and a very cheap game. It's like $4-$5. I played this for an hour. So, it is definitely a unique experience, regardless of how I felt about it. I played this on the big TV with my wife. I never would have played it by myself on the computer, for one thing. But it's like, if you've got a group for it, it definitely feels like it's designed. It's one of those games that feels like it's meant to be streamed. Like, obviously, the big reaction games. A game to react to. Very popular on Twitch and other streaming platforms. Yeah, it is a little strange in some of the ambiguity I'd mentioned in terms of, like, what counts as haunted or not. Obviously, it's hard to know when that is just the game being a little bit clunky and a little bit broken. Like, there was definitely some bugs that I'd come across. And it's hard to know when that's, you know, the points versus just the game being fairly cheaply made. But it's... That ambiguity does add to the horror at the same time. Like, the moment you lock things down and make everything ultra clear, that takes away from some of that horror as well. So, I know, it's definitely something to it. The overall structure was a little strange. It's like this almost roguelike structure where you have to get 8 correct answers in a row. So 8 houses, whether it's safe or haunted, you have to get that correct 8 times, and then you see an ending. I never got to that. I got to, like, 6 at max. And then you basically have to start from scratch, like a true rogue-like, essentially. That sort of is a bit deflating in terms of the tension and the horror. And I think the game is most interesting when it breaks from that format as a couple of more scripted events, shall we say, that broke outside of the core rules that you're generally going to come across. So it's a little meta in some ways. And it also, like, understands too, it takes that core gimmick of the concept and makes it, like, more personal. Story with there is something going on with why your character specifically is there. So there's a little more to it there. I didn't quite see the ending. I wasn't quite sturdy enough. I was a little bit frayed by the end of my hour with this, but it was worth it for something unique for an hour or so.
Cool. All right. So that's Cabin Factory, the Cabin Factory, and you played this on Steam or
on Switch? Platform? But it's on most platforms now, I believe. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So from the Cabin Factory, we're going to be moving on to another type of factory. In this case, it's Rune Factory. This is the Guardians of Azuma, which is the sixth entry into this long-running now hybrid RPG series. But I don't think it's actually the numbered 6th game. I think there is actually a Rune Factory 6 coming out. So Guardians of Azuma is the latest one. Came out in 2025. This game is published and developed by Marvelous. I don't know if they have some suffix at the end of their name, but it's Marvelous is the logo that you see at the beginning of the game. So, Rune Factory. A bunch of different versions of the game have come out before on various platforms. I own the last couple on Steam, but there have been ones on, like, I think 3DS. I think Rune Factory 4 was on 3DS, for instance. So, out on various platforms. So, this game is interesting in that it's not another JRPG. I promised I wouldn't be covering just RPGs. This is a JRPG hybrid. It mixes JRPG gameplay with romance, relationship simulator, plus a farming game. So essentially Rune Factory is a spin-off. I don't know if it's an official, but it is essentially a spin-off of the Harvest Moon / Story of Seasons games. So unlike those games, you generally start off, you are inherit some farm for some reason, and then you're given, like, very simple tools, and then here's a little plot of land, get started, clear the land, plant some seeds, and off to the races you go. So that is very much still there. You have the basic overall premise of you have a timed day, and you have to clear land, produce goods, ship those goods, sell them, and then make a profit if you can sell enough. And then you use those profits to invest in more crops, more tools, better facilities, maybe even some livestock eventually. This is very, very common stuff, right, that you've seen in many, many games, especially the myriad of Stardew Valley likes that have cropped up since that ultra kind of ultra popular meta game, kind of genre redefining game came out.
Definitely broken out of containment in terms of a very niche, what was previously a very niche subgenre.
That's right. Essentially, farming games are kind of like at the core of cozy games, which is a very, very popular concept right now. Not every cozy game is a farming game, but it seems like most farming games are cozy. This game is not exactly that. So a lot of those farming games just focus on the farming, and they focus on the relationship building. Those are kind of the two pillars of that genre. And those are two very kind of juicy, interesting mechanisms, so there's nothing wrong with that. But also, those games can tend to be a little bit repetitive, if that's essentially just what you're focusing on.
I mean, a lot of people want that, something predictable, and having a formula that they can follow day by day, right? Something they can return to and know what they're going to get.
Absolutely. And maybe that kind of like lack of friction or that focus on a very specific target is what people really like about those styles of games. So no shade on that. People who love it, that's fantastic. What I'm trying to say is those are meaty game mechanisms on their own.
Mm.
But this game adds a third pillar to it, which is the kind of adventuring. So in addition to those elements, this game adds tried and true JRPG elements to it. You have weapons. In this game, you have access to a range of weapons. Short sword, a two-handed sword, bow and arrow, and then you have this kind of fourth, rune casting thing, magic casting kind of gloves, or I don't even know what they represent, but you have a range of battle styles, let's just say. And essentially, off of every town is like a path that's like, be careful going down that path, because beyond those doors lie monsters. And this is the setup for this particular game, Guardians of Azuma, is you start off in a simple town called the Town of Spring, and there you're front-loaded with a whole raft of characters. There's about a dozen NPCs in this town, some that you have to interact with, and then a whole range of characters that you can optionally interact with to develop your relationships with them. Those NPCs have a range of types of jobs. They might be the blacksmith. They might help you construct buildings, or they might run the local tavern or shop. You eventually go out into the kind of the wilds where there are monsters. And this game, Guardians of Azuma, is the first entry into the Rune Factory series where it has a very distinct East Asian aesthetic to it, and East Asian theme, and it's basically fantasy Japan. Basically, if you've played games like, what was the one I was thinking of recently? Monster Hunter Rise? Don't know if you played that entry, the one for the Switch specifically.
Right, yes.
And Steam has a very kind of like fantasy Japan theme. It's like, it's basically like Naruto or something like that. It's a very, very hyper, kind of exaggerated Japanese aesthetics and kind of over the top. And this one is just that. But unlike Monster Hunter Rise, this one is very colorful, bright, bubbly, just like a lot of the other entries into the series. The previous five entries have focused more on kind of Western European trad fantasy or kind of verging onto maybe like Industrial Revolution, steampunky kind of aspects as well.
I mean, so even Stardew Valley has a dungeon, basically, that you can go into. I know it's not several other games, like My Time at Portia, I think was the one I played that had quite a lot of sort of dungeon delving in that. Obviously, this is blowing that side of that percentage of the game, sort of blowing it up to be fairly equal to the farming side, would you say?
I would say most certainly it is. Mm. I would say that the farming aspects are definitely there. They're fairly central, but I would say that they're not even half of the gameplay of this game. You have a unique job to do in this game. You're not only the owner-operator of the farm, But you eventually, and this is fairly early in the game, so I wouldn't consider this a spoiler, but eventually you are asked to become the new chief of the village. So basically there's the old chief. He's going on in years. He's you know, still he's a tough guy, but he says, you know, I would really feel better if you would agree to help guide our village. And you, of course, have no choice. You have to accept it. So you kind of take on the role of like the entire mayor. So you're the farmer, you're the fighting hero, and you're the mayor of this town. Yeah. So kind of managing the town is about 40% of the game, 40% of the game. Your relationship building is about 20% of the game, and the last 40% or so is the fighting adventuring. So still fairly balanced aspect of it. It's certainly not a side show. The role-playing aspect of it is fairly robust. All the action is in real time, and this entry is fully 3D. I think Rune Factory 4 kind of has still had, even though it was 3D, it had this kind of very over-the-top, top-down perspective, very grid-like perspective, kind of like the old Link to the Past or the old original Animal Crossings.
Okay.
No, isometric is at the angle, but this one is the very like square, right, top-down view. But I think Rune Factory 5 and this one, Guardians of Azuma, has opened it up to be fully 3D, still third-person. But the combat is all real time, pretty capable. It's still very like loosey goosey if you compare it to something like Elden Ring or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's not nearly as precise. But for being not a primarily RPG or certainly not an action RPG, it's pretty robust. You can invest in a lot of different upgrade trees. Like I said, you had at least those four different types of weapons. You might have more. Over time, I only played about the first 8 hours of this game, but I still felt like there was a wide variety of certainly weapons that you can take on. And basically, there's like three key areas that you can develop in. It is your weapon skills, magical items, and then your kind of practical skills like cooking, farming, crafting, and that sort. So weapons, I already mentioned what they were. Basically, you just kind of flesh them out and gain new attacks. So as you choose to apply your XP and invest them in certain areas, you kind of have this like grid pattern, very much kind of like the later Final Fantasies. You have a skill grid that you sphere grow grid, out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe not exactly sphere-like, but yeah, a shaped grid. And those middle items I mentioned were magical items. So this game is quite cool in that it has, well, it streamlined a lot of stuff. And that's why I really came to enjoy the farm management, because it streamlines a lot of the frustrating kind of busy work that a lot of these farming games have.
Mm.
And I know you've played some of these. You played Harvestella or something.
That's one that's definitely year, right? Come to mind. Yeah, I can't remember if I discussed it in detail here, whereas that had relatively simple farming and relatively simple, you know, spamming the attack combat mechanics, if I recall correctly. But in a way, it was greater than the sum of its parts, essentially. That those two systems feed into each other in a nice, complementary way, which I think is what you'd really need here, rather than have two distinct systems that just feel like two different games bolted onto each other.
Yeah, I didn't get to play Harvestella, but I'm glad to hear that it managed to balance that well. I think this game balances quite well also. I was mentioning those magical items. One of the items is this like a traditional Japanese drum. And basically, if you hit the drum, it has multiple effects. One of them is to heal your party members in a radius. And yes, you can have multiple party members, which is kind of cool. In a Japanese action RPG, you can have AI-controlled party members of the NPCs that you are forming relationships in town. Mm. You can, I don't know if there's any limits to which characters, but all the mainline characters you can romance.
So you can take your farming wife on adventures with you.
Or husbandos or whatever. Right, yeah, definitely. You can take up to three townsfolk out with you to adventure all the time, and they kind of manage themselves.
Nice.
It's kind of cool. You can equip them with distinct weaponry, So you can make some of them ranged, you can make some of them close melee combat, some of them use magic, so that's quite cool. Oh yeah, I just remembered what I was talking about with the special items is, so the you can heal your party members that are nearby you, but you can also use the magic drum on your farm as well. This is kind of like a cheat, and I was really surprised that they let you do that, but you can basically go to your field, and you can plant and water your plots of land. You plant seeds in them. And then if you use your magic drum and expend some of your mana, so there is a cost, I suppose. You can't do it unlimited fashion, but it basically advances the growth time of the plants. Mm. So maybe it might not complete plants, but it might cut out 1 or 2 days of their growth time. So if you did this a couple days in a row, you can quite steadily advance the rate at which these crops cultivate.
So is there a strong sense that like progress you make in the farm is contributing to the adventure side and vice versa?
Yeah, definitely. So basically there are primary main story missions that you get dealt to you by various villagers in the places that you visit. There's always a primary mission, and you're never going to be lost as to what you should do next. There's always going to be a big old pin on the map that tells you where to go next. That said, you might have 5 or 6 missions going on at any given time, so you are also not lost for a variety of things that you can do. Beyond that, you are also there are basically mini goals that you can find posted up on a bulletin board, essentially, in your town. Sometimes there's multiple bulletin boards throughout your town. There's multiple save points throughout your town as well. I think this game is very, very well designed for kind of smooth ease of gameplay. Basically, everything is close at hand. Anything you might need is close at hand. You're basically given these smaller requests, which are like, give me 3 of these magical items, or grow me 3 of these, or build 1 of these buildings. So very kind of minuscule goals. And you'll find that maybe like 5 of those might show up every morning when you wake up. And funny enough, you might find that out of those 5, 3 of them you've already accomplished because you just have the items in your inventory that you collected in previous days. Or you might collect the items as you're out in the field destroying some monsters, and you're collecting their talons or something like that. So everything is feeding into itself. Mm. You are getting constant hits of dopamine as you complete those missions and turn them in. And basically everything is dinging, ding, ding,
lots
ding.
Lots of checklists.
in a very kind of like holistic cycle. So this game is great, would be great for people that just want to like maximize their activities. And actually, I said I played for about 8 hours in the week that I had it from the library. Mm. But my oldest kid, they played it for about 10 or 12 hours.
Wow.
And I ended up unlocking 2 villages over the course of my play. And this is a really cool aspect of the game, is that the first village was a decent size. But at some point, maybe about 4 or 5 days in game days, they're telling you, oh, you have to leave the village to fulfill this mission to do something with your dragon companion, because of course you have a dragon companion in this game. And all the villagers are like, oh no, don't leave us, I might have feelings growing for you. And things like that. They're dropping hints of their affection for you, even though you showed up a week ago. And so you end up leaving all this dozen or so characters that you're just starting to build these relationships with. And then you're flying in the air on the back of a dragon, over which there is this vast sky full of floating islands. So you realize that this one fairly robust town is just one of many villages and areas that you can explore. It's very similar to the overworld in Tears of the Kingdom.
Hmm, well.
So if you can picture that, there's a bunch of like floating areas. Each of them hides a little bit of mystery. Some of them are minuscule and they'll find 1 or 2 nice items or upgrades on them. And then a decent number of them are these larger, robust areas.
How different were these two experiences? Like, is it a fairly linear progress with the game? Or is there much difference beyond which wife or husbando you choose?
We didn't compare notes that closely.
Okay.
But I was really surprised that they were able to access the four towns, essentially. Mm. I knew just by using logic that there would be four towns because the first town was called the Village of Spring.
First year.
Second town was the Village of Summer. And then fall and winter. So I knew that that was going to be coming. But I was surprised that they were able to access in such short amount of time. And they seemed quite hooked on it.
Okay.
I could see why. Like I said, you get constantly dealt all these opportunities to progress, to achieve, to level up, to reinvest, and to grow. And the really cool aspect of this that I was surprised by is that in every one of these new towns that you visit, there's a whole new cast of characters. Like, so those dozen people I met in the first town, they don't live in the other towns.
Thought to have regrets as to who you married.
Yeah, well, you're out on a journey, and you'll discover a whole bunch new
wife cast in every town. People.
Yeah, everywhere you go, and there's opportunities. I think eventually you build like these kind of like locales that will like attract, like you build like an onsen in the second town or something like that, and then visitors come, and some of those visitors might be from your first town, for instance.
That's cute.
I could see where this sort of stuff is developing. Like another game that we actually covered on our show, I was reminded of the game Disney's Dreamlight Valley. We talked about that a year or two ago, and
haven't thought about it again.
Yeah, exactly. It's a very basic game design. But like Dreamlight Valley, there's basically this sort of like corruption that exists throughout the lands. Okay. And through, because you're the chosen hero, you're called the Earth Dancer. It's basically, you're this kind of like shaman. And you use your magical drum and you use your wand of plum blossoms or something like that. And you clear the corruption from the land, and you basically make it whole and pure again. And the cool thing is that the new towns you visit, you can clear those plots of land as well and create new plots of land to grow crops in. And the townsfolk that you befriend, or you might even be saving some townsfolk through the course of your adventuring by defeating monsters. You might defeat some bosses. There are bosses that gate your progress from time to time. Depending on your progress, you might rescue a bunch of new villagers. They move into your town, and you can assign those new villagers roles to do in your town, like maintaining your farms. So there's a kind of like a town management automation quality to this game as well. I think they tried to do something in one of those recent games from, what was it, from Capcom. The name is sort of escaping me right now. It was on Xbox Game Pass about 6 months ago. I'll try and remember the name of it, but I love that aspect of acquiring new townsfolk and assigning them jobs. It's very much the kind of like RTS quality of games, of management games that I enjoy. I think I mentioned something like that in that discussion of Whiskerwood.
Yeah, we talked about it and how that quickly that can get overwhelming and keeping track, and especially if you're trying to optimize and min-max who's in what role, or if it's just fairly like flavorful and just enjoy the vibes.
Well, in this case, it serves a very practical purpose, which is that you probably won't have the opportunity to tend to all of your gardens, all of your plots in all of your towns over the course of the game because you'll be off adventuring. Well, you don't have to worry because when you're off adventuring, if you assign them your villagers right, they will manage your farms for you. So there's a give and take, there's a push and pull. And all in all, this is a kind of a very fluid, very smoothly designed, or maybe almost like too smoothly designed. It's good for your smooth brains out there. No, that's very insulting. I think this game has a lot of clever aspects going to it, but it's extremely streamlined. And I suspect that my oldest kid, very intensely into it now, might reach a certain plateau of excitement because, you know, eventually it gets repetitive.
Mm.
That said, there's been a lot of cool character moments. The design is really nice. It's kind of a little bit over the top. It's kind of like your postmodern East Asian fancy mythical costumes along the lines of your Genshin Impacts or things like that. Lots of flourishes and
over-designed, maybe?
A little over-designed for my taste. But over the course of the game, as you meet more and more characters, you do notice that they're actually pulling from a bunch of different periods of Japanese history and different historical costumes and garb. So it's not just one note. They're painting it by one note. They're actually taking a lot of care into the designing of some of these characters. It is quite tropey, as you might imagine, about a modern Japanese dating simulator. Mm. You're going to be playing with a lot of tropes and a lot of stereotypical characters. But the characters that I have met so far have been quite charming. And I'm looking forward to getting a copy of that game again. Sounds like my kid has asked for a copy for their Christmas present. So maybe I'll be able to borrow a cartridge to continue my play session as well. So that's a lot I covered. This game seems to be doing well. It's gotten ratings are around, I think, 81%, 82% from Metacritic and OpenCritic. So that's pretty high, pretty solid compared to some less highly rated entries previous to this in the Rune Factory series. So I think it's going to do pretty well.
So I've definitely been starting to feel the cravings for a farming game again. My kid and I briefly tried Animal Crossing. I know that's not exactly the same thing. There's an itch there, and I'm trying to figure out the best way to scratch it, essentially. Obviously, it's ultimately going to come down to the characters, essentially. Like, how much do you feel for these characters and get invested in their lives, essentially. So I think that's probably the biggest benchmark of all. How are you feeling about that side of things?
I'm actually quite positive. Like I said, I only played about 8 hours, but the scenarios have been pretty interesting. Like, some of the characters act in unexpected ways. Some of the character resolutions are interesting. Like, there's a lot of humor. There's a lot of kind of like really stereotypical characters that are kind of like one-note gags in their own right, but those gags are still funny. So I appreciate it, and there's a lot to love. I haven't even dug deep into the relationship building, but what's there, I think you'll be rewarded pretty handily. You can do gifting, you can do conversations, you can just, out of your day, it's a very scheduled thing, so like the minutes pass very quickly, but you can say, spend 10 minutes to hang out with this guy, spend 30 minutes to hang out with this lady, or do these favors. One fun job is that there's just these frog sculptures all around the world. And this little boy is like, I'll give you a reward if you for every 5 frog sculptures you find, I'll give you a reward. So even that is just fun in its own right, just a little bit of exploration. This game has surprising good chops. Like, it's a 3D platformer as well, not the most robust 3D platformer in the world, but handily, it does the job handily well.
Awesome. Yeah, I might check that out sometime.
Yeah,
recommend. Okay, I'm starting to feel the post-con crash, to be honest. So I think we might start wrapping this up and jump to dessert, if that's okay.
Works for me. Let's do it. You want to start us off?
Sure, why not? So having finished Shocktober, working through horror movies for the month of October, my wife and I have moved on to Novumbo. So that is for November. We've started to look through the Columbo series. Is that a series you're familiar with at all, Mark?
I know of the kind of the
archetype.
The archetype of Columbo, the kind of the really smarmy, hey, I got all the answers and I'm gonna catch you in the act sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I was never really exposed to that the character at all growing up, but I was surprised to see just how long lived it was. Like, so basically I've watched the first film. There were 2 standalone films before the series. This first one was Prescription Murder, in 1968. And I believe the last film was in like the 2000s, early 2000s. So that is a, you know, a long-running saga of that character. I'm led to believe this, that first film is a little different in what the character eventually becomes in the series, but it was still incredibly captivating, especially such an old film. Like, this was for Peter Falk. I think it was the third iteration of that character. It appeared in some other like skit shows and things, but this was the first sort of feature length expression of this character. But one of the biggest surprises was like how little he is in the film. Like, it's, I think it's half an hour in until he appears, you know, much like, you know, Alien I was discussing recently. He funnily enough, he does show up like a jump scare, like Alien. Whereas most of the film is from the perspective of the perpetrator. Like, arguably, the protagonist of the film is, you know, someone who's you see the murder, for lack of a better word, happen, and you know who did it basically, and it's just a matter of will they get found out essentially, and how will this, you know, fine net of alibis get unraveled essentially. So Columbo will just show up as a jump scare randomly, you know, lock picking this guy's door or just like walk into his office and surprise him. So you never really get to see Columbo's interiority. He just, you know, just shows up and delivers this monologue, and very disarming act. It is quite fascinating watching the way he sort of just sidles in with his very unassuming attitude, very a lot of personal anecdotes and talking about his wife and how his wife loves to do this and so, and then just come in sideways with, oh, just by the way, one more thing. And it really is quite a charming, you know, performance and character, the way that's performed. There is one moment in this movie where the mask comes off and he, like, the real sort of aggression and sort of almost predator underneath comes out. And I have to believe that is not really expressed in the later series. But that it was really captivating. I was surprised. I'm looking forward to checking out more of those. I know there's a long run of them. It will take us a while to get through, but the first Columbo film did leave a strong impression.
Really cool. I had no idea that there were films for that, because it's a TV series as well, right?
Yeah, well, I think like it was these first two films and then several seasons of the series, but I think even later there were still movies later on. Like, after the series had wrapped, they started releasing like one-off specials into the 2000s, essentially, that were a little more spread apart.
That's really cool to hear. If you're good with your desserts, I would also like to talk about some maybe some murder mystery afoot.
Okay, go ahead.
So the item I want to talk about for my dessert entry is called Murder on the Marine Express, which is a video game, but it has no interaction to it. So that's why I considered it pretty much. Is it a game? It's a visual novel, squarely. This game is available on, I think, a bunch of different platforms. I played it on Nintendo Switch. It's from 2021, from 1564 Studios. And this game is very short. You can also find it for very cheap. You can readily find it for like $2 or $3 on sale. And this game has a very simplistic, low palette, color palette to it. Pixel graphics. Very, very simplistic, but still kind of charming look to it. Cast is mostly young women, because the premise is that you're on the maiden journey of this transoceanic vessel, which happens to be a train that's running in a tunnel under the water, thus Murder on the Marine Express. So you're stuck in this submersible tin can, and you have to go from Japan to the west coast of the United States, for instance. I think that's the premise. And wouldn't you know it, a murder happens. And that's this whole visual novel happens. But you're in luck, because amongst the group of schoolgirls is a really sharp proto-detective character. I think her name is, what is her name? Togawa, Ranko Togawa. So she's a Japanese named character. And the cast is actually quite diverse. There's a range of young women from different international backgrounds. I don't think it's a Japanese game, though, even though visual novels is a very popular category in Japan. I think it's a Western, I think maybe European, potentially, studio. based on the credits that I saw when I rolled at the end. This game, like I said, is quite short. Run takes about 3-4 hours. The only interaction is pressing the A button to advance to the next piece of dialogue. And the scenes are generally, here's a backdrop, there's two talking heads, and you chat back and forth between them. You meet the dialogue. The dialogue that's there is actually sharply written. I really enjoyed the writing in this one. It's quite smart and humorous at points. The cast of characters is really quirky. It reminded me a little bit of that manga series Kaguya-sama, Love is War, that I mentioned a little while ago. Just kind of these like school kids that are just way too smart for their own good. The story does actually take a decidedly non-wholesome twist because, of course, there's murder afoot. But also, content warning, there is sexual violence. And there's, you know, against minors in some cases. So this isn't for everyone, and it might trigger some audience members as well. But it starts from a very humorous place, and it handles some of those dark twists fairly respectfully. The girls are always in control. And they're always kind of managing the flow of the plot. And it wraps up in due time. There's no actions on your part as the player.
There's no interaction. Is there at least some interesting like framing in how information is presented? Or is it largely just like text, you know, character talking, character B talking back and forth?
So there is one element of the game that is missable, per se. So, like, you do take in all of the main plot because of the dialogue, and it's presented in a very linear slideshow fashion. But behind the scenes, you have a cell phone, because, of course, you're a young woman in a modern age. The cell phone contains, like, a list of the cast of characters that you discover. So that's really useful if you want to just remember this character's name, because, of course, they're all suspects, right? Want to remember their background, what they look like, their name, where they come from, their history. And there's also this like group chat thread. And every few scenes, a new group chat comes out. And you just see this little icon in the corner that says you got a text alert. And basically, these ones are non-interactive as well, but they are basically color commentary. It's body is found, they add a little bit more background, like explain what the other people that are not in the scenes are feeling at the moment. They're afraid, they're cracking jokes, there's some dark humor in there. So there is those elements there that add some more texture and round out the characters a little bit more. So that part of it is nice as a little small diversion. But if you're not in the mood to just read dialogue, that's basically all this game has going for you.
Like, is there voice performance?
There are no voice performances.
Okay, so you are reading it. Okay.
Very, very bare bones. Yeah. You're just reading it. Very low res, pixelized text. And at the end, you're presented with a very true to its form, satisfying conclusion of explanation monologue at the end.
The train did it.
Right. Exactly, very much like Sherlock Holmes or Benoit Blanc from Knives Out Murder. You have the explanation by Ranko Togawa at the end and her intrepid investigative partner, Astrid. And they explain out the whole scenario. And there's actually a little bit of a twist. The scenario that she explains to the bulk of the people doesn't turn out to be the whole story. So maybe it's worth sticking to the end. But it's $2. It's not even a big investment, even if you end up quitting it halfway through. But if you stick with it, it's not that long, and it's like just reading like an enjoyable short story. I recommend it. It was a good experience. And I think there are other entries into the series as well, these Ranko Togawa mysteries, they're called. But this one was called The Murder on the Marine Express.
Well, there you go. You got some murder mysteries, some factories, some quality assurance. a few through lines on today's episode. But lots to get you through the next month if you're looking for some entertainment.
There you go.
If you have any questions or comments on today's episode, you can contact us at omnigamersclub@gmail.com or at our website, omnigamers.club.
That's right. You can watch us on YouTube. in video form. We post videos of each episode that comes out. And if you want to catch up on our back catalog, our very earliest episodes, our a few earliest dozen or so episodes are in audio form only on a podcatcher of your choosing. Please send your feedback, comments, and subscribe on either of those platforms. You can visit our website or follow us on social media, because we just do this show for the fun of it. We don't have any sponsors. So your feedback inspires us to keep going. That's what Mochi says anyways.
Yes.
And how do people get in touch with us, Daniel?
Or you can find me at Blue Sky over at Board Game Feast at bluesky.social, and the Omni Gamers Club account is there as well.
Yep, and you can catch me as Mark Uessa, MarkYuasa, at bsky.social. Love to hear from you there.
Excellent. Well, thanks, Mark. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And again, remember to have a balanced diet of games. Bye.
Bye.